brothers and sisters, or sisters and brothers, whichever way you like to put it. In our languages in India, we have a common word, but in English, unfortunately, we can't use one single word to speak of brothers and sisters. I am very happy to be able to be present with you all on this very special, joyous, important occasion. And also to bring to all of you felicitations and very warm greetings from our international headquarters at Adyar and all the international officers. It is also our prayer, as Joy already mentioned, that the future will be a glorious one. The subject which I am going to speak about is not new to Theosophists. Perhaps to a new generation of Theosophists it is. But at a certain time it was expected that in Australia and in America, the United States, particularly California, a new consciousness would grow. We need not be concerned with the geographical location so much. But I think it is important for all of us to consider whether there can be a completely different kind of civilization. And what we as Theosophists need to do to usher it in. I'll put forward before you certain thoughts which have occurred to me. You need not, of course, agree with me. Agreement is not called for. But I think whether we agree or not, if we apply our minds to this question and explore what it means to bring about a new way of life, a new kind of relationship, a different kind of consciousness, we would really be advancing the theosophical cause. Theosophists are meant to be pioneers, not just in doing things. It's easy to start a new movement, set up a new institution, but much more difficult to ascend or descend, both mean the same thing, to a different level of consciousness. And that only can usher in a new civilization. We are in an age of progress. And we have been very proud of it. There have been many extraordinary events during this particular century. Perhaps we have reason to be proud of some of the achievements. But as you know, many great civilizations have perished in spite of their achievements and their glories because they have neglected certain aspects of life and allowed evil and superstition to grow and be perpetuated in certain forms. The end of every civilization has come through unawareness. And our much-wanted age of progress, the present civilization, if it's civilization at all, and that is one question we must ask seriously, may also die because of the maladies which afflict us, afflict it. What is the progress that we have really been engaged in? To me it seems, perhaps you will not agree on this point, largely progress at the same level. Progress in knowledge, for example, but knowledge of the same kind. Knowledge which is based on accumulation of information. We are in the information age. And this collecting of information is equated with progress. We are able to obtain more and more information at increasingly rapid rates, to analyze, evaluate, come to certain conclusions, and do many other astoundingly skillful operations with the mind or with the computer which the mind has invented. But civilization is not necessarily a matter of increasing the kind of information one already has, information at the same level, based on the same methods of obtaining that information. We will come to that by and by. So, can we pass on to a more civilized way of life simply by obtaining greater knowledge of the same kind that we already have? There are many other aspects of progress which we have been concerned with. And we may discover, if we explore the question, that all of them mean that we think along a certain rut. This century has perhaps seen more destruction of life than any other in any previous age. Think of the millions of people killed not only in the great wars, but in the innumerable conflicts which have gone on everywhere. The massacres which have taken place in concentration camps under the hands of dictators in various countries. Think of all the millions of creatures which we are continually putting an end to. The species we are destroying, the animals which we trap and kill by the millions. Perhaps such cruelty, such callousness with regard to life and murder, if I might use that word, on such a vast scale, has never taken place before. And what is the solution we offer? It's always a solution along the same lines. People are slaughtering, have been slaughtering each other in Bosnia, in Rwanda, in Angola. I need not give a list, but we think of sending peace missions, perhaps of revising various articles of the international laws, of bringing about truces. But these are all well-known ways of non-achievement, because the situation remains the same. We don't ask radical questions, which may perhaps mean that we will be led into thinking quite differently, into persuading ourselves to having utterly new sort of relationships. Long ago in the United States, Chief Seattle, whom perhaps till recently many people considered as a barbarian, as a primitive man, asked more or less, I'm not quoting his words, a fundamental question. To whom does the earth belong? And if we really go into that question and find the answer, perhaps we may arrive at a different kind of solution to the question of conflicts. At least, if we think of the great conflicts, they have all been over the question of possessing the earth, some part of the earth, and the resources there, of acquiring new possessions, having domination over various regions. What crimes have not been committed by nations as well as by individuals for pieces of the earth? But we have not asked ourselves, who possesses the earth? To whom does it belong? What right have we over particular areas of land? Does not the earth belong to all that lives? Not only to human beings, but to all the creatures, however important or insignificant they are. It's because of man's interference, in fact, that problems in nature have arisen. Just now they are culling elephants in Africa, thousands of them. But this kind of destruction of life would not be necessitated if we were not continually trying to occupy land in order to increase our comforts and our pleasures. I would like on this occasion to bring to your attention a few words of Dr. Annie Besant, speaking on the fact that so many of our problems in the present world, or rather the present civilization, seem to be intractable. The problem of war, the problem of poverty, the gulf between the rich and the poor, and a variety of other problems. She said, every one of the problems must be solved by the spiritual intuition of man. Every one of them must be dealt with not only by the strong intellect, but by the living spirit, that sees the one life. The living spirit that sees the one life is the consciousness of the theosophist, the true theosophist. It is the consciousness of the truly religious person. There is no difference between the two. Did not Madame Blavatsky define theosophy as the wisdom religion? Not a religion of churches, of authority, of obedience, belief, conventions and rituals, but a religion which belongs to the pure mind, a mind which is not polluted by the sense of possession of self and of ignorance. So it is of the, it is that mind, the new consciousness, if we want to use the word consciousness, which can really bring solutions to our sad world. Madame Blavatsky also spoke about this, what the theosophist has to do. She said that if the doctrines of theosophy are seriously studied, they call forth, by stimulating one's reasoning powers and awakening the inner in the animal man, every hitherto dormant power for good in us. What a remarkable statement. And also, such study should stimulate the perception of the true and the real as opposed to the false and the unreal. She says this in her beautiful essay on Is Theosophy a Religion? And if we go on to a more recent exponent of the religious mind, J. Krishnamurti, he says, when the mind is swept clean of image, of ritual, of belief, of symbol, of all words, mantras, and repetitions, and of all fear, then what you see will be the real, the timeless, the everlasting, which may be called God. But this requires enormous insight, understanding, patience. And it is only for those who really inquire into what is religion and pursue it day after day to the end. Only such people will know what is true religion. It is only when the mind is in revolt against all so-called religion that it finds the real. So, theosophy, the wisdom religion, which implies the transcending of the ordinary mind, passing to a different level of awareness, awareness of the one life which is everywhere, is the clue to a new civilization. Because when there is this living spirit, as Annie Besant calls it, that sees the one life. I think the phrase is important because it's not the ordinary mind which thinks about the one life, which perhaps has theories about it, maybe give lectures about the one life. It's not that mind, but the other kind of mind, which she calls the living spirit, which does not merely talk or think, but sees, perceives, to use HPB's phrase, that there is but one life. It is that which they will be able to find solutions to the problems which exist today and bring about a new civilization. And I think as members of the society who are in earnest, we must apply ourselves to this question very seriously. What is that kind of mind? What is this wisdom religion, which is theosophy? Can there be any form of sectarianism in such a consciousness? A feeling that I am this or that. We are reminded of what is said in At the Feet of the Master, what religion a man holds, to what nationality he belongs, all that has no importance. The only thing which is important is to become aware of the great plan, the direction in which the whole movement of evolution is taking place, how perfection is to come to every living being. If one can even have a little glimpse of that, it is said, then life becomes completely different. In that wonderful book which has inspired so many people, At the Feet of the Master, there is an illuminating phrase asking every person whether he stands for evolution or for selfishness. If there is to be a real change, progress, then the mind must cease to be selfish, sectarian, divisive. If it continues to be that, then there cannot be a new civilization. There is so much talk of a new age. Well, if the term is understood in the right way, perhaps it's not very different from saying a new civilization. But often it suggests that a particular formation of stars or the passage of certain number of years or something like that is going to bring about a complete change in human life. But from the theosophical point of view, the change to a higher degree of culture and civilization can come only if there is a change in the human consciousness. A new civilization does not come by itself if those who compose that civilization are not civilized. So we have to ask ourselves the question, what is a civilized consciousness or civilized mind, a civilized state of being? Perhaps this important point is very pertinent, that mind must be free of any tendency to divide itself against others in terms of not only nationality and race and religion, but also in terms of importance, of intellect, of culture, of social position, so that a certain freedom from identification with this or that group takes place. That space within the mind is extremely important. Recently, in a conversation, Professor Ravi Ravindra, with whom most of you, I suppose, have now become familiar, was mentioning that California is different from other parts of the United States. I don't know if that is true. But the reason he gave was that all those who break away from conventional thinking from the ruts in which most people are caught tend to move to California for whatever reason. Some of them may be rather queer specimens. There may be a certain amount of lunacy, shall we say, in some of them. But there may also be the fact that to come to the new, one has to let go of old concepts, of conventions and patterns of thinking that we have adopted without serious investigation. It's so easy to become conditioned and to cling to things which are psychologically satisfying. The religious mind, the truly religious mind, cannot be a dependent mind, dependent on scriptures or gurus, on particular forms of worship or dogmas, on anything. It must be a mind which, as Krishnamurti says, is ready to inquire. And it is what everyone has said. HPB, if you read her words carefully, has said that if the teachings of theosophy are to be understood in depth, then the student must put aside all that he has previously known and all that he has acquired from the environment, from previous studies, from everything. Every time we approach our studies, we have to approach them with a fresh, probing mind, which is concerned with truth and not with things to which one has become attached. The Theosophical Society has a marvelous motto. I don't think there can be any other motto which is so great. There is no religion higher than truth. And if we look at the civilizations of old, why were they civilizations at all? Or in some cases, great civilizations. There is perhaps a difference between the word culture and the word civilization. They are much discussed words. People have tried to understand the meaning of these two words. You can speak about a primitive culture, about the culture of people who have adopted all kinds of superstitions and cruel practices. But civilization, I think, means something else. Civilization is the rising beyond such superstition and ways of ignorance. You will look back to Greece, for example. You will find that what made Greece great as a civilization was the fact that they had a perception of truth in the form of beauty. It was that one thing the discovery of truth as beauty, which made Greece great. Not the works of art, but the consciousness of the Greek people, which explored the whole question of beauty and truth. We will not go too far in considering that particular topic, but we may think of other civilizations. There have been civilizations which have found the truth in the form of order, law. The whole universe is order, as we know. In fact, in the theosophical teaching, we are told that law is not different from God. If there is any God, it is the law. Even scientists have found that the very nature of the universe is order. And to the extent that a people were able to recognize order, an internal order, a harmony of the parts with each other, they discovered truth. And in that case, that civilization became great. If we look into the Hindu civilization, they recognized the truth of freedom, of inner freedom, and all the different aspects of society, the many different disciplines and studies were organized to come to a deeper and deeper understanding and realization of the nature of spiritual freedom. And therefore, that civilization can be called great. So, this coming to the truth, the deep elements of truth, in those elements which we recognize as beauty, as harmony, as goodness, and so on. That is a very important aspect of civilization. And the religious mind, the theosophical mind, has to be concerned with the discovery of truth, and nothing should take precedence over that truth. Not the words of the scripture with which we are familiar, not the thought which is prevalent in our particular environment, not what our parents have said, not even what our teachers said. That is why the great teachers, like the Buddha said, do not accept anything, not even my own words, as truth. Inquire and find out for yourself. What you find out may be what the teacher has said, but it has to be your discovery, your realization. So when there is that seriousness in the search for truth, and it becomes more important than all our other loyalties, attachments, identifications, we are willing to drop them all, then perhaps we can begin to see the one life which is everywhere, in every form. And out of that may come a different kind of morality. Because an understanding of morality is the crying need of the times. We see immorality everywhere. Incredible cruelty. You must have read about the experiments performed on living human beings who've been implanted with isotopes which are highly dangerous. But this is not new. Secretly it has been done everywhere. And a human consciousness which is capable of inflicting cruelty on any kind of a creature is surely capable of doing the same thing to another human being also. So, cruelty is part of our age of progress. There are appalling violations of human rights, but our morality does not take into consideration these happenings when it does not suit us. Every nation talks about human rights, but when their own commerce, their profits are at stake, they choose to ignore those rights. And they talk about something else. We are all aware of that. What about the rights of the Tibetans today? Tibet is being occupied by the Chinese. That is why His Holiness the Dalai Lama is so anxiously working day after day for the liberation of his people. We are not concerned with the question of political freedom. But the violation of the rights of the Tibetans becomes unimportant when it's a question of making profits from trade with China. I'm only giving it as an example of how our morality gets restricted. Our sense of morality is restricted when our interests are at stake. And therefore we must go to that great statement in the Mahatma letters, that universal brotherhood, this consciousness which is aware of the one life in all forms, is the only secure foundation for universal morality. If the new civilization does not have a higher morality, it will not be a new civilization, whatever configurations the stars get into. So I think it is important to realize that the ushering in of the new civilization is in our hands. And to become aware, to come into realization of that unitary consciousness, is not a question of abolishing differences. It would be easy to do that. Perhaps the people who can now do cloning will one day produce a human being who is convenient and multiply him a million times and replace all the difficult people with the clones. We may do all kinds of extraordinary things like that, but it will not solve our problems. It is the seeing of the one life, is seeing the richness of that one in the diversity which is all around us. It is like the banyan tree. Some of you who have been to Adyar will know what a magnificent tree it is. Our Theosophical Society has often been compared to the banyan tree, where branches and trunks everywhere, and each trunk can be as strong as another. And so the tree spreads and gives protection and shade to many. But that tree comes out of a tiny seed which is no bigger than a mustard seed. In that seed are contained all the branches, all the roots, the foliage, the spreading trunks, Everything is within that seed. But when the seed sprouts and grows into the tree, we see how rich a thing is that seed. Of course, we have been often told about the color white. Out of that one white light come all the colors that we know of, the beauty of the sunset, the most wonderful paintings we know. All the glory of this earth is just that one light. So, to see the unity is not to suppress the existence of diversity, but to see all parts of that diversity as one harmonious whole. And what will that vision, that realization, which is theosophy in the deepest sense of the term, do to our society? I think it would abolish the profligacy, the waste which is part of our, I was going to say present civilization, but I question whether it is really civilization, our present world. We are wasting everything in nature, and merely to snatch a little bit of pleasure, have a little more comfort, have a few more gadgets, and we shall perhaps disinherit ourselves. But if we became a little more respectful of the life which is everywhere, see the beauty and the glory of it, we would revert not to a previous age, but to a style of living which is extremely simple and austere. I cannot see a new civilization which is as wasteful as ours. Can we not proceed towards that even now? Do we need all the things that we crave and we use? Can an example be set of living with just what one needs? We are all familiar with that well-known statement that the earth has everything that is necessary to fulfill the needs of all the people, not only the people, but all the creatures of the earth, but not to cater to the greed. So, can we confine ourselves to needs and not encourage greed in ourselves? It is that greed which is leading to this competitive way of life. In her book, I suppose written more than 100 years ago, Practical Occultism, HPB already mentions that competition, the spirit of competition, which is being bred in our present society, is the cause of many of the calamities which afflict us. And the competition would come to an end if we contained our greed. So the religious or the theosophical mind must learn to be aware of where greed on the scale which we find today, as well as incredible affluence. This is not the gulf which exists between the affluent countries and the poor countries only, because even within the poor countries, you find that there is the same vast difference. People enjoying luxuries which are sickening. There was an article very recently in Newsweek about the filthy rich of Russia. Russia has been going through an economic crisis. Most people there do not have even $100 a month as an income. But there are the few who have already become so rich that neither the Americans nor the Swiss, nor I expect the Australians, can afford to go to the places where they go or eat what they eat and clothe themselves with the garments which they are able to buy. So in every society, this difference comes about. How is it that so soon, in what was meant to be an egalitarian society, this difference has arisen? It's only because of the greed in the human mind. So there will always be inequality in the world as long as the mind does not change and become free of the desire for acquisition. The teachings of yoga, in fact, deal with all these questions. The fundamental of yoga is the learning the nature of morality, non-injury, because one respects all life. Again, we must say that respecting life does not mean that we think all people are equal in wisdom or intelligence, in skill or virtue. It is not so. Hierarchy does exist in nature. If we read theosophical books, we know that there are intelligences far above us, and there are also intelligences which are below us. In fact, these words above and below are irrelevant. They have no meaning, because when the stream is flowing, the water which is here will be there tomorrow, and the one which was there will be here. So these are terms which we use out of our ignorance. But to be aware of the one life means that we pay equal respect to all, because that one life, that divine presence, is everywhere, in every form, in each atom, in every infusorium. There is much in theosophy about all this. So we must not believe that leveling everybody down in some way is a process which will bring about a different kind of society. Democracy, I think, should not be that kind of leveling down, but a question of giving respect and opportunities for every person and for every creature. Because I think to give opportunities to grow inwardly, fulfill its own dharma to every creature, non-human creatures, is as important as it is to give it to the human being, because it is the same mind which is at work in all relationships. Now, we can find millions of animals in small pens, put cages, put birds in cages. Is it part of nature's process to put these animals in strict confinement? How does their evolution take place? What did the great intelligence of the universe plan for them? Surely it planned for the bird that it should fly, move about, experience space, and so on. And its inner evolution depends on that. And so does the evolution of each person and each creature depend on what nature has brought that creature to. And it is not our business to restrict that by the unnatural things that we do to them. So respect is due to everything that lives, to all the plants and the animals and the people that we can think of. And to come to that feeling of respect, as we said in the beginning, it is not enough merely to increase knowledge at the same level. Not even if we obtain knowledge of the etheric world or the astral world or of psychic things or cosmic rays or whatever it is, are we going to bring about a real change, ushering in a new civilization. That will come about only, as we said, if we are able to see, perceive with a new kind of consciousness which has a different kind of knowledge, which is the knowledge of meanings and of purpose. For that, HPB says, the innate powers of the soul must be developed. It's not enough to become intellectually clever. It's not enough to learn how to be practical and skillful. But to develop that innate power of the soul, the intuitive faculty which sees into the meaning of things, which can transcend all arguments and come to the essence, the truth of what is, a training is necessary. And it was that training that we spoke about. When the mind becomes free from that mind where all impurity in the form of division, of selfhood, of ignorance is removed, that mind will then be able to become aware of this truth which is within. And there is, in the present day, in our society, a strange superstition. The superstition that this consciousness, the wisdom consciousness, can be reached by doing nothing. Perhaps performing a gimmick. But again, to quote Annie Besant, you cannot suddenly entrust your body to a man in the street. You need a doctor who has had years of study, training and practice. If you are seriously ill, you wouldn't like to go to a quack. If you are in an aeroplane, you wouldn't like to give the stewardess the position of the pilot. It wouldn't be safe. In those days, they didn't fly. So Dr. Besant said, you don't ask the cabin boy to become the captain of a ship all of a sudden. But the modern superstition is, part of that superstition is that a person can change by putting on a different dress, performing a gimmick or a so-called miracle, and immediately he becomes wise, full of spiritual knowledge. But the true theosophical tradition says that this can only come through patience, patient training, continual self-understanding and observation. Self-knowledge is the mother of Buddha. Buddha does not mean a historical character. The Buddha is the awakened one, the consciousness which is enlightened, and that consciousness arises only from self-knowledge. So a new civilization must come by training oneself to become inwardly pure, not by allowing oneself to go after pleasures, indulge in all the fancies of the moment, get distracted by the innumerable objects which are available, enter into competition and so on. The training comes when one realizes with a steady mind that truth alone can save us and save this world from further sorrow and bring about a different kind of society and civilization. And about that training, about that self-purification, about treading the path to wisdom, there is much in theosophical literature. Much of it is forgotten. We may think that it is old-fashioned. We may dismiss it because it doesn't suit our desires. But the way to wisdom has never been easy. That is why in all traditions they have pointed out that it is a difficult path. It is like climbing a mountain. Straight is the path and narrow is the gate. One requires perseverance, patience. One needs to purify oneself. And then perhaps one can walk forward. In the Upanishads, they called it the razor edge path because one has to tread carefully. One can be tripped up easily by temptations. There are no temptations outside. Temptation, all temptation which seems to come from outside is only a symptom that there is some desire, some self-interest, some ambition within. So if we conquer all that, then perhaps become aware that life is truly one, then we would use whatever is our position in life, whatever opportunities we have for the sake of others. Today, the Dalai Lama is speaking all over the world about universal responsibility. The spiritually aware individual, the truly religious person, feels responsible for the welfare of all that lives. The great Bodhisattva vow is that as long as there is even a single creature who suffers, let me not go even to the highest heavens or find the bliss of nirvana. It is in that spirit that one has to tread the path to wisdom. H.P. B.'s great statement, which we know and which I will not repeat, but entitled The Golden Stairs, indicates what are the steps to be taken towards the temple of wisdom. We can ponder over all those phrases. Every phrase is of great importance. It starts with a clean life. It doesn't mean taking a shower once or twice a day, but we have to examine what it means to be really clean inside, upright, not deceitful, not trying to appear other than what we are, and so on and so forth. So if we take all that seriously, perhaps we will be acting as pioneers, bringing the whole of this world towards a different, happier condition. I will end with another quotation of Annie Besant. There is no need to be pessimistic to be dejected, because inevitably the new will come, the dawn will break, but we have to work for it. And she says, there is the dawn of a better day breaking, a day when cooperation shall take the place of competition, when tenderness shall replace for the miserable and degraded the violence and force which now are so evident, when none shall be content to be happy while others are unhappy around him, none be willing to be learned save as he uses his learning to enlighten the ignorance of others who are miserably neglected, when none shall be glad to be called rich unless he holds his wealth as a steward holds the wealth of his master, to be rightly administered and not as his personal possession. We all know, as well as the other phrases which they have mentioned today, the sentence, theosophy is altruism. Theosophy has also been called philanthropy in the deep sense of the term, not merely doing good actions, but having that heart, pure heart, from that pure mind, from which everything that comes out is good. Unless we usher in an age of altruism, there will be no new world, no new order. And it is that kind of civilization where wisdom reigns, where purity of mind leads people along, that as members of the Theosophical Society, we must work for.